Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Yes. Nice to always look at things in a different way. Today we want to talk about truth and innocence, and we want to talk about gullibility and cynicism. And things like that. In the studio with me, my dear friend Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, welcome back to the station. It's getting to be a habit.
It's good to be back. Thanks, Ian.
Yeah. And also in the studio with us, Anne O'Connell. Anne O'Connell's a fascinating kind of person. She's an attorney. You said there are no ex-attorneys?
No, there are no ex-lawyers.
No ex-lawyers. Once you pass the bar, you're a lawyer for life. Can't you resign your lawyership?
Well, you don't have to renew your bar dues, but once you've gotten a JD, you're a lawyer.
I understand. It's like having a family. But that's what you were, and that's what you did, and then you switched out of that, and she became a psychotherapist, consultant, social worker.
Go figure.
And some really interesting stuff that you've done. Tell me, let's just start off with that. What made you switch out of law, where you could have made yourself a lot of money and done legal things and help people in your own kind of way?
Well, that's a great question. I had practiced law for 10 years and always enjoyed being a lawyer, but never absolutely loved it. And I think the thing I liked the most about it was the human interest aspect of counseling, kind of the story with each person, each client whom I was counseling. And I always enjoyed that piece of the puzzle. And that really got me jazzed. So that in a combination with a bunch of things, I eventually decided to make the jump.
And you made the jump into going to social work school to treat people. And now, let's talk about what you do specifically now.
Right now, I work at an outpatient mental health clinic in the Bronx. And the population we treat is the severely and persistently mentally ill. So a lot of former drug abusers, people with psychosis, pretty serious diagnoses. And it's just an outpatient clinic. We do individual and group therapy. And we have a team of psychiatrists and social workers. And it's a good place.
It's a good place, and I know the place. And Kent, do you know the place as well?
I do know the place, sure.
How do you know it?
Oh, it's well thought of as a place in the Bronx.
Well thought of as a place in the Bronx. It's well thought of as a treatment center in the Bronx that does decent stuff.
Right.
And they do decent stuff because they're combining, they're not just supplying drugs to people. And one of the unique things we have about both of you as representatives is that you both believe that psychotherapy is kind of essential as part of a treatment. Don't you, or close to it? Do you think counseling has got to be an important part of it? Don't you believe that, Ken?
Oh, absolutely. I think even just in terms of a psychiatrist, compliance with medication, there needs to be some kind of alliance with the doctor in order to trust the doctor that the medication is the right medication, and have a dialogue if there are problems with the medication side effects and the like. So even as a role as a psychopharmacologist, there has to be some kind of rapport that will help the compliance with medication.
Well, you know, I mean, here comes the question. If you're a social worker, a psychiatrist, a physician, patient comes in, they tell you a story. Now, what do you have to consider when a patient comes in to tell you a story? Do you think to yourself, I'm thinking about all the physicians I've known who, when a patient comes in to tell them a story, they're not even really hearing. They've heard a small part of it, and you could say to them, Doctor, my ear fell off, and I put it back with crazy glue. And he's saying to you, well, how many times did you have to get up to go to the bathroom early last night? Because all he's caring about is his checklist. So physicians have learned to be skeptical in the self-reporting of clients because they believe that the client doesn't know themselves well, that they can't really tell you what's going on as well as they may be able to tell you what's going on. And then that's in some cases. In the other case, people who consult with both attorneys and with social workers and with psychiatrists, they frequently don't tell the truth. They're not giving all the facts. Let's think about it in the criminal law system. Legal aid, you're a criminal lawyer, you're there to defend somebody who is given to you pro bono, or you're doing it, you're not going to make any money by it. What's your attitude? What's the attitude of a lawyer who kind of comes, you don't know if the person's guilty or not guilty. What's the attitude?
Well, ethically speaking, I think every attorney has an obligation to defend their client to the best of their ability, using all parts of the law that support the client's position to the best of their ability. And really, their guilt or innocence shouldn't be a factor, but we are human, and it can be a factor in how rigorous, perhaps, if you're a criminal defense attorney, or a legal aid defense attorney, your defense is.
Well, you say it shouldn't make much of a difference. What is it that the famous judge once said about?
Well, I think the best legal mind is a detached lawyer. The best lawyer is a detached one, emotionally detached.
Well, I don't know. If you know my cousin, remember my cousin Vinny, the movie? You know, if Vinny is fighting for you and he's emotionally attached and he's trying to defend you, he's certainly going to do a better job than somebody who sleeps at night. If you have somebody who's going to stay up all night doing research, they're going to do a better job, don't you think? Or do you think being involved sometimes makes you become a worse lawyer?
Well, we're human. I think that you do get involved to a certain extent, but I think sometimes the emotional attachment can cloud your judgment, and perhaps you don't see the forest through the trees as you should, and don't see all parts of it. And you do not want to get into emotional argument in the courtroom. You want it to be tied to the law, and I think that's the emotional detachment that's important.
So now let's take a look at mental health. In mental health, a client comes to you and they come to you for a consultation, or they come to you up at your place up there in the Bronx and they're going to try to get their medications. What's the questions you're asking yourself about the person coming in? First of all, I remember, Kent, I wanted to bring this to the audience the other day. Somebody comes in to see you. 13-year-old boy comes to see you, and you say to him you don't want to prescribe him Adderall because you're afraid he might wind up selling it to the other kids.
Right.
Right? I mean, what kind of skepticism is that? Somebody comes in, he's a 13-year-old boy, and you have to be careful what you prescribe because you're afraid the kid's going to be selling it as a drug?
Sure. I mean, I think that everybody with some known history of substance abuse, doctors in general have to be a little wary about prescribing medications that for some people they can use responsibly, but if they, you know, not to say 100%, but if they have a history of misusing and abusing kind of yummy, kind of feel-good medication, then sleeping medication, attention deficit medication, anti-anxiety medications, or something, you have to have a healthy skepticism that this person isn't going to be able to take this medication responsibly because they have a history of taking other substances irresponsibly.
So does that mean that, Ken, you're just, when somebody comes to you, a big percentage of your treatment has been with substance abuse, you don't trust anybody?
Well, I always tell them, I trust you, it's your disease I don't trust. And when I'm talking about the disease, I'm talking about the disease of addiction. So I try to distinguish in my own mind, and perhaps in their mind, that they have what I like to call, you know, a disease of addiction, in which they'll do almost anything to support their addiction. They'll lie, they'll manipulate. And for many people, that's not really a part of their personality and character, that they're not generally manipulators, they're not generally liars, but in supporting their addiction, they can certainly be capable of lying and not telling the truth.
And, you know, and people feel really insulted by that, because they want to be trusted by you. They want to believe they could come to you, the psychiatrist, and tell you the truth and you're going to give them the medication. But sometimes people will even ask for medications that are harmful for them, thinking this is going to be the good thing. So the real question is, are they telling the truth to you, and are they telling the truth to themselves? And this becomes an essential question of psychotherapy. Person comes in, a client comes in for the first time, and they see a therapist, and they say to the therapist, my husband, my husband, my husband. The therapist is not thinking, how do we solve the problem with this husband? The therapist is in general thinking, how do I help this person become more peaceful with themselves? The therapist then says to themselves, I notice that the client is focusing their attention on the relationship with someone else, but not being introspective and not looking at what part they participate or contribute to this. So the therapist says to themselves, well, they're going to talk about their husband, but I'm going to wait for an opening where I'm going to help to point them in the direction towards themselves. In effect, the therapist is saying to the client, you're a liar. And yet, of course, it would be an insult to say that to a client. You're not going to say you're lying because the client doesn't even know they're lying to themselves. Do you find this all the time? You find it with therapy? Well, let's think about what happens up at your clinic. And when somebody comes up to the clinic to try to get methadone or something like that, I mean, do they want insight-oriented therapy or...
Well, that's a good question. There's many clients who just want medication, and it could be for a number of reasons. They could be someone who just is too scared to look at themselves.
What does that mean? Too scared to look at yourself?
Well, I think their ego support is they have a very very low tolerance for they have a low level of ego support. They may, on a subconscious level, feel that there are things within them that they're ashamed of, that they don't want to look at, and they just can't, you know, the thought of one-on-one therapy for a lot of these type of patients is very scary, understandably.
It's a good question. I want to ask all three of you that, and by the third, I say it's Stephanie Dombra, who's also here in the studio with us today. Hi, Stephanie. Glad you could step in.
Hi, Armand.
So what is this thing about insight that people want to avoid so much? What is it about looking at yourself? You say ego support, and those are good words, but I imagine two boulders holding people up and that they're going to crumble. What do we mean? Why isn't a person willing to look into their background and see what part are they participating in the grief and pain that they're going through right now?
Well, I think that looking at oneself honestly is a very difficult thing to do. And because I think that word shame that was brought up before is really gets to the core of it. Because by definition, I think any self-critical look at behaviors and ways of interacting that's not optimal brings on a slight level of shame. I would say a healthy shame. That shows, you know, that I'm imperfect, I'm doing the best I can given the childhood that I came from. But for many people, I think, who are fragile, that have their self-esteem is rather fragile, that process of an honest look in the mirror at themselves is very difficult, because any little bit of looking at a mistake or an imperfection feels like I am a mistake. Not that I'm okay and I have some imperfections, and my parents may have contributed to some mistakes that I currently have. When I say to myself, I made a mistake, or there's a mistake in my behavior, I feel like a total mistake.
Like you're a broken toy, like there's something wrong with you.
I also think, Armand, that people are afraid to look at themselves because then they'd have to look at their needs. And often people are ashamed of their needs. They feel like, I can never get these needs met, and I can't afford to let anybody know about that, because then I'm always going to be in this cycle of looking, let me get into this relationship with this man, and maybe he'll be able to fulfill these needs that my parents didn't get. So I think there's also that kind of denial of that. They want to push their needs down often. That's what I find as well as a problem.
And I think also that it's very difficult for these type of patients to distinguish between behavior and the core person, so that they can think that, yes, they're ashamed of their behaviors, but they don't stop there.
Could you
give
me an example of that? Let me have one I could see. What behavior? Ashamed of their drinking.
Someone is ashamed of their drinking. They cannot control it, and they think that they are a bad person. They are completely responsible. That they're, you know, sure, people talk about in theory a chemical process going on or an organic process going on, but that it's something they should, if they were a strong, healthy person, could control. And they take that as a personal failure and loss rather than a behavioral problem.
It's kind of tough. It's very tough because if you're ashamed of who you are on the inside, I think a lot of people, you know, think like things like people in dysfunctional relationships will very often stay in dysfunctional relationships because they don't want to be alone. And if I were to ask somebody who walked in my office and I said, well, why do you want to stay with that person? If they had the courage to, they would say, because I'm afraid to be alone. But they can't see that part, or they can't admit to that part. So what they do is they work another one, and they're saying, you know, they could go into instead, well, because I've got to kind of work it out with the person, and they will stay stuck in a thing, where sometimes there's a basic truth underneath that people are not willing to face. And that basic truth, if it were just available, would bring the person closer to their own honest life. But unfortunately, when you're not willing to look at yourself and you're not willing to see what's inside, the best you've got is automatic behavior and repetitions. More and more repetitions of dysfunctional patterns. Which is why, I guess, whenever you get drug treatment, you get people who are reluctant to do therapy. Is that true? Is that true in general? Did you find that true in general, Kent?
Well, I think that, again, to have personal responsibility for your behavior is not an easy thing for people with addiction in general, because there can be a tendency to what we call externalized blame, where there's not a healthy sense of shame and owning responsibility for the behavior. There's always some but at the end of the sentence. There's always an excuse or a rationalization. I may have done that, but it was because somebody made me, or because of this external event made me pick up heroin or made me do something. So that I think that, again, that tendency to try to blame others or try to look outside oneself as, well, you know, I'm really not responsible and I really shouldn't have to feel badly about it because I just reacted to something on the outside.
My guest is Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, and the indefatigable Ann C. O'Connell. Ann O'Connell, who is the attorney-turned-social worker-turned-therapist, who has some dynamic insights into the perception of how people are and how they function. Stephanie Dombrow, also staff psychotherapist here at the DeMel Center, joining us in this conversation about people and the kind of trust that seems to try to take place. Now, people do not trust, do they trust their therapist? I mean, they walk in. Do they trust you when they come to see you?
Not at first. I think trust is a very difficult thing to build.
Well, you're a tough person to trust, Ann, because not when you're in your private practice, but you're tough up in your role up there, because if they get you feeling negative towards them, they may not get their medication. Is that true?
Absolutely. And I think that if they are already predisposed to not wanting psychotherapy because they're someone who has a difficult time looking inside, being introspective, then my role as a therapist, according to our policy at this clinic, is that if you see a psychiatrist for medication, you also have to see a therapist, because the idea is that there really is something going on with you that would necessitate therapy if you also have an addiction or something.
And they offer therapy
disorder
to everybody, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is psychotic. There are people looking around town trying to find some kind of a decent treatment. You offer therapy. You say if you're going to do medication, you must have therapy.
You must have therapy. So
you're a believer that therapy is just about good for everybody, don't
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. I think that not everybody is ready to be introspective or to look inside. But at a minimum, one important thing, talking about trust, is really to build the relationship with that person. So if it's, you know, you may take a long time before you even look at any issues, but I try not to be casting any penalties if they do not come in for therapy, but rather just trying to reach out and encourage them to come in. But sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes they see me as the bad guy because I just want them to come in for therapy, and they really just want their medication.
And you have nothing to gain by it. I mean, it's your job, but you don't get money for it, do you?
Of course not. I mean, that's part of my job, so I don't get any. No, I mean, it's part of my job responsibilities included. It's But, you know, it's just sort of a, something you do. I mean, those of us
so
in this
here
business.
We go. Here we are, four mental health practitioners whose job it is to get somebody to value themselves enough to be willing to face some inner demons. And those inner demons could be anything small, like a small amount of shame, a memory of something they might have done once in the past, something that they may have believed, some feelings that they might have had. I can't tell you how many kids I've known who have wished, have felt angry towards their parents and feel such a terrible feeling about the anger that they felt, that they don't want to explore their relationship with their parents because they're afraid they're going to uncover this anger. And they're going to feel terrible for having felt angry at their parents. And it's a small thing. And you talk to them and you say, so you got angry at that point? And they said, yes, I did. And you show them it's acceptable. And it kind of brings a tremendous amount of relief. So, but here we are, four people who believe, talk to me and I'll help you. I mean, you believe that. Do you believe that, Stephanie? I mean, it's like it's an absolute belief on your part?
It's an absolute belief. And I feel like I also have another perspective as a mother. I have two kids, and I absolutely make sure they tell me when they're frustrated. And we laugh after. We're always saying, you know, I was so angry at you. I'll say that, or my daughter will say it to me, and I'll say, but don't you still feel that love? And I really think that most of the people that are walking around never got that opportunity, and that's what brings them to therapy. And they have to practice this experience of going to a therapist and saying, I am angry at you because you didn't get my point or you didn't meet my need. And that's what I try to do with my clients. I try to say, can you please tell me if there's something that I did that makes you upset? And if you set that up, that gives them the training for life outside. I always say, I'm helping you to get out there in life, to live with people, to make relationships. And the way you do it is to practice with me. And so I try to do it in all areas of life.
So this precious relationship of therapist to client seems to be more about just the insight you provide and the tools you use to go digging. The main thing is you can have an experience with one other human where you can trust yourself to open up your own heart and to find out what's inside. It's a precious gift.
It can be a, what they say, a corrective emotional experience, that someone who didn't have that experience with their mother growing up, you know, can have that with the right therapist.
That's where I think you come in here, Kent. I mean, you're a guy who likes to give away the goodies. You know, you could easily be making some small fortune being a psychiatrist to the wealthy on Central Park South, seeing people for 15-minute appointments and charging $500 a session. It's a breeze for you. You like to talk to people.
I'm a schmoozer, yeah. I like to talk.
What is it about your role as a psychiatrist that lends you so much to wanting to be there emotionally for people?
Well, I think that the aspect of trust, I think, gets to one part of therapy patient relationship, where when we're talking about a therapist's responsibility to point out things in the person's behavior that they may not want to look at, I think that there has to be this level of trust that my motivation, the therapist's motivation for doing this, is coming from a wish for you to feel better. My feeling is a lot of patients we have, they come from households where a similar dynamic with their parents were going on, where the parents were correcting them. Their parents were pointing out mistakes and the like. But the feeling they had, and the feeling isn't often not correct, that the parent is in fact sort of enjoying pointing out the mistakes, that there's some kind of sadistic pleasure or sort of I'm better than you feel of, you know, of pointing out the mistakes, the misperceptions that the patients are bringing in. So I think the level of trust, similar to when you go to any kind of you know, getting an instructor in yoga or a piano instructor or something like that, that their job is to point out ways that you're doing things incorrectly, and you have to feel like they have your best interest, even though it may feel a little painful to hear some of these things. It's not what you want to hear. You want to rent a friend. I mean, I think most people just want to come in and say, yes, my wife, yes, my husband, and have you nod and say, you're right, you're right, you're a victim. I think it's at a conscious level, a lot of people just want to have a rent-a-friend and have you agree with them. I think they need some pointing out what is their responsibility, and they need to trust that the therapist is coming from a very good, loving, and helpful place, even though it may sting a little bit, what you're telling me.
And I think the most important thing, as you were saying, Kent, is the relationship, which goes back to trust. I mean, that has to be first and foremost for the therapist in the beginning part of the therapy, so that the patient can get to a point where they can hear you say, let's look at this behavior. Let's look at this problem.
And have you had any experiences where somebody seems so immune that they couldn't be possibly care about internal observations or introspection, and they wound up sharing themselves with you on some level, and it made a change in their lives?
Absolutely. I mean, it sometimes will take 9 months of working with someone, and
you're working with pretty serious crowd there. You're working with people who are very seriously disturbed. Give me a story.
Well, I have one client who, her diagnosis is schizophrenia, and she had a pretty bad episode about 10 years ago, and luckily was saved, if you will, and is now since married and has a 7-year-old child. And it took her about 6 months to tell me about the sexual abuse she suffered, and to really open up. She would just sort of come in and, everything's fine, my husband's being nice to me, and everything very sort of on the surface. And she then said to me at one point, there's something I want to tell you, I'm just not ready. And it was about 2 or 3 sessions later when she did. And since then, you know, we've had a very good relationship. And I've actually been able to help her more with some child-rearing issues that I can sort of say, look at this, are you doing this the best way you could? Whereas I don't think I could have gone there beforehand because I don't think she trusted me.
It's very, so it must have touched your heart quite a bit.
Sure, absolutely. I mean,
what was that session like for you? I mean, when she was that one of those hours that last forever?
It was actually a half hour. That's how long our sessions are. But it was. I mean, it was one of those that makes it all worthwhile. One of the reasons why I, you know, left the legal field and all of those trappings to do psychotherapy is very rewarding. And it was. It absolutely was, yeah.
If you think about the precious times in your lives, you as therapists, and the precious times, the ones that really count. You know that one story? I had a story. I had a young girl once who came to me who was in an auto accident. And all of her family was killed in the accident, and she wasn't. And she listened to them die. So she was mute. She's one of our listeners, by the way. She might call. And she was mute, and she wouldn't speak, and she wouldn't speak, and she wouldn't speak. And they brought her to my office every day. And she sat with me, and we just sat, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, until finally she spoke to me. Her name is Debbie, and I heard from her 20 years later. Married, children, everything okay. But, you know, I remember the first words that came out of her mouth. And the first words that came out of her mouth, she said, is it okay if I scream? Things like that, you know, which is part of what brings us to what we do. It's different. It's different than supplying somebody with tangible goods or selling a product or selling an item. You know, we're really merchants of the heart. And there's something quite beautiful about that. We're going to be back with you in a little bit. My guests, Ann C. O'Connell, psychotherapist, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, psychotherapist and psychiatrist, right? And Stephanie Dombra, assistant director, manager, and controller of the universe. We'll be back with you in just a tiny bit, my friends.
Hi, this is Danny Glover, and you're tuned in to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Thank you.
not? Beautiful summer day, spring day. That's Redemption. Israel Lopez, Cachaito. Hey, this is Armand DeMille. It's Orlando Cachaito Lopez. Music. Armand DeMille here with you with Ann C. O'Donnell, Stephanie Dombra, and Kent Robertshaw. Three people in the studio today talking about psychotherapy, medication, and treatment of different sorts. You know, and if you have a question, by the way, Stephanie Dombra just reminded me, we didn't get much of a chance for you to ask about your own mental health. So today may be a day you could do it. You might want to address either of these three people, 212-209-2900, or me, and we'll maybe take your calls and talk about it. So let me carry on this conversation first. So what happens after a while is a client comes in to see us, use, guys, and when the client comes in, they're going to report a story. And the story, obviously, is not one they could understand. They don't understand their story because they think that what's wrong with them is what's wrong with everybody else. You know, that their husband is wrong, their wife is wrong, the people are wrong, the boss is wrong. The skill of the therapist is to aim that thing back to them. Is to say, yes, I understand you are the victim of the world. But let me show you something about how you contribute, collaborate in this position of being victim. How you have almost an investment in it. And now let me show you where that is and why that is and how you do it. And let me show you how to step out of it. That's your job, right? And when you don't have, when the person doesn't have the mind to do it, sometimes two of you, like you both say, medication. You might need a medication to do it. If you have somebody who is schizophrenic, actively schizophrenic, you believe you want to offer them insight-oriented therapy, but you want them medicated first. Why is that?
Well, I think they need to be stable. I think that you don't want the patient to be psychotic or, you know, decompensated, and think stability, especially for someone who has a diagnosis of schizophrenia, is important first before you can think about any kind of insight-oriented therapy.
What's it like doing therapy with somebody who is actively schizophrenic, or maybe not so actively schizophrenic, but controlled schizophrenic?
I think it's much more symptom management than it is insight-oriented. The insight-oriented clients that we work with at my clinic are much more people who have substance abuse issues. They are hopefully at some point able to have some introspection. But someone who is psychotic is generally symptom management and supportive therapy, really just being there.
Well, you know, the way you say supportive therapy, it's as if you reduce that and say, well, it's not real therapy. It may not be insight-oriented therapy, but the relationship between you and a patient who is schizophrenic is so essential.
Absolutely.
That if your connection works, it's as good therapy as insight-oriented therapy.
Absolutely.
I mean, who cares why they get better as long as they get better?
Absolutely, and it's the relationship, like we were talking about earlier. That's the most important part. I have a group I run that's all people with schizophrenia, and the best part about it is that they come every week. And that they get something out of that. They may not be able to connect with each other, but they have formed some level of attachment, and they come, and that's part of the therapy.
You run a group of all schizophrenic people?
I do.
How many people?
There's eight.
Are they all fantasy? Are they all in hallucinations or?
Most they are all stable now. I do have one that talks to herself throughout the group. But it's difficult to have them communicate with each other in words. So we often work in activities. That really brings them together, tasks. And
what kind
concrete
of tasks might you do?
We play hangman. We tell stories. And we, you know, just more concrete tasks.
And when they're looking at you, so when you have somebody looking at you, and I worked with a similar population at the Rehabilitation Institute in Mineola years ago, and I remember when I was talking to somebody about what seemed like I was talking about a task, they were looking at me. One man told me, he said, "I see you have the head of a chicken." And he said, you know, when you move your head, he said, "I could see you will have the head of a chicken." And he really saw a chicken head on me. And I'm talking to him, and I see just a regular human, and I'm assuming he sees a regular human. But he saw chicken heads. And somebody else heard me whispering to them in their rooms when I wasn't there. And they heard me having the voice of God. Now, with this kind of delusional stuff, you carry on a conversation with them and you have groups with them as if they're normal, or as if, what do? Do you practice as if it's regular people? What do you do? How do you do it?
Try to meet the client where they are, really. You know, one thing we also do is we will have them draw their, write up their recipe for happiness. So, you know, one cup of love, spoonful of family, things like that, and that is how they. Each one is individual and different, and they. I don't know exactly how they see me. They could see me with a chicken head. I don't know. I haven't told me that.
So, do you act as if they don't? Is the way you function as if to say, "I'm dealing with humans. It doesn't matter how they see me. I'm going to just be myself, and I'll be my best professional self with them."
Best thing I can be is myself. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that my experience is that I feel it's our job with psychotic patients to gently reality test them, and gently being the operative word, but I think it's somewhat, I try to, you know, say I may not share your belief that the FBI ... you know, that try to ground them a little bit, to challenge some of these, misperceptions. But the ache of schizophrenics and to love and connect is powerful. And yes, playing hangman in a group is not sitting alone watching television, smoking cigarettes, which they can do. So even though they're not in touch with reality, they have an ache to be around other people, to connect with other people. And I would say other creatures, because I've seen work with schizophrenics and animals and the like. And, you know, it just, they come alive because it's very difficult for them to interact the way most of us interact because they're not in touch with reality. But they have an ache to love and be loved like all of us.
We throw that word around, schizophrenic and psychotic, because we're familiar with it. Let's describe what we're talking about when we talk about that in a person.
Yeah, I think that the definition would be somebody who loses touch with reality, and that would either be delusions, which is a belief system in something that's not real, like a paranoid delusion about being watched by the FBI or Martians after me, delusion, and the other aspect would be hallucinations, perceptions that are not real, seeing things that aren't there, hearing things that aren't there. So I think the two main categories would either be a belief system that's not based in reality, or perceptions that aren't based in reality.
And if you have that, you have a person who's walking around seeing things differently than we see it. And we believe, we have to believe, that we are the representatives of reality, and that what we're going to do for this person, the person who is schizophrenic, is we're going to say, "Well, here, let me tell you what reality is, because you're afraid that reality is what you think it is. You're afraid that reality is that everybody's talking about you, that people are out to get you. You're afraid that reality is that nobody will ever love you or care for you. Now, I've got a dose of reality here that I live with, and it's my code. I live by this reality. So I'll say to you, no, I don't think that there's somebody waiting outside the door ready to bop you in the head. I don't believe it. I'll even go and look with you if you want." And that's what you can offer. You can offer them, "Here, I'm a stable person. And if you don't feel stable, let's go check it out. Let's go see what we could do to make this more real."
I wanted to add to the activities that you do, because one time I worked also in a clinic, an outpatient clinic, and it was a day treatment. And one thing I found that really worked, or two things, were dancing. Once again, I've spoken of dancing on the air several months back. I did a group with clients that were severely, persistently mentally ill, and I got them up and started moving and dancing and playing music. And this was like they've never experienced this, of just getting up, smiling, getting out of their thoughts, because that's one of the issues. You know, they could stay withdrawn in their mind and have all sorts of dialogues and conversation. But when you're moving your body, you're touching a different sense. And that was really helpful. And another thing was actually guided imagery. Even though I'm doing the talking, they're following my words, and I'm bringing them to these beautiful places by relaxing and going to beautiful landscapes and beaches. And they were able to do this. And no one's ever given them that gift of really relaxing. It seems like they're relaxed, but they're not, probably internally. So those were two things that I found really touched these people.
So here's an extraordinary reality that the three of you are presenting. We're talking about Stephanie Dombra, Kent Robert Shaw, and Ann O'Connell. The three of you are saying your world is a pretty nice world that you live in. And when a person comes to see you and they pay you a fee to see you, you're saying to them, let me show you what it's like to be sensible. Sensible meaning okay, not overreacting, not being so reactive, not being so passionate. Now, however we've got to do it, however we've got to help that person, and there's a range of experiences here and a range of procedures and processes that are used to help stabilize a person in this room. It's amazing. We have cognitive behavioral, we have medication, we have intense feeling psychotherapy, primal therapy. We have such a range of tools, but whatever it is, what we're trying to do is get a person to know that they're okay. Basically okay.
Yeah, and I find a lot of our patients, we're talking about loss of touch with reality. The bread and butter of a lot of patients seem to be depression, and depression having an aspect of feeling down or feeling low about themselves, and people's perceptions of themselves can almost be psychotic, how negative, how dark, how mean they look at themselves. You know, the anorexics who think they're fat is just one example of the tendency for people to be so harsh with their own self-evaluation.
The dysmorphics in general. I mean, all the body dysmorphias. You want to talk about those?
Yeah, the people who are obsessed with some aspect of their appearance, which makes them feel unattractive and undesirable. They can't get out of that obsessional thought that there's something wrong, something lesser than, something defective. They're a dented can. They're only worth 49 cents. They're not the $2.29 can of peas. They're the dented can. They're only, you know, in the bin worth 49 cents. Something about them makes them feel less worthwhile than other people.
And so we take this person and they go into a place up in the Bronx in a pretty rough neighborhood, and they go knocking on a door and they see Ann O'Connell, who, if you see her, tall, attractive, intelligent, successful person who sits there and looks at you and takes you and regards you. Now this regarder, right? Regarder la neige. That was the first thing we learned in French. You know what that means? Look at the snow. But the first regard that you have for a person, when a person feels regarded, it's amazing. I remember a friend who used to have some trouble with in his store. People would come in and they would claim they were unfairly treated. And I watched once this social worker, Anita Eisenberg, actually it was. She was in a room, she was in a place, and a woman walked in and she said, "I bought this here and I was cheated and I want to get my money back," and they knew they didn't sell the product. But the person was off the charts upset. And nobody in the store knew how to handle it. All they could deal with it is, "We don't sell that product." But if you have somebody who's decompensating, which means breaking down in front of you, and she's screaming and yelling, how are you going to handle it? Well, I was with this person, Anita Eisenberg, who stood up, went over to the woman, and said, "Oh, I see how upset you are." And what she did was she validated the person. She regarded the person. She ignored whether or not the product was bought there. And almost by magic, brought that person back down, down to where she said, "Well," and then the woman finally said, "Well, I did buy it here, didn't I?" And Anita said to her, "Well, I don't know if you bought it here or not, but I certainly see how upset you are. And if you did buy it here and they wouldn't take it, you should be upset. We'll check on that for you." And the entire store kind of watched the magic of this mental health practitioner go to work and get somebody who seems so far out of control in control. Well, that's what you all do. You all deal with people who feel out of control.
And also, I think we deal with people who don't get a lot of attention. I think that is a very important part of what we do. You know, there's a famous line in The Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. And for this person who walked into the store, she projects that she brings out in other people people who do not want to be around her. But for this social worker to have paid attention and the relationship and the positive regard is so important. I think that is the work, you know, that is part of the core work right there.
Well, now we move on to that whole concept of doing treatment whenever there's a substance abuse or any form of addiction. When the person comes in to see you, you could regard them positively, but like you said, Kent, you don't regard the addiction. You don't trust the addiction. So you could have a client come in to see you, and the client who sees you is telling stories about their lives and their belief system. You don't have to believe them. You don't believe that they're right. They wonder, what do you think? Should I have hit him or should I not have hit him? Waiting for you to make some kind of a judgment. Well, that's not what it's about. It's about you being able to make contact with a person to a point where that person could eventually calm down enough to realize the world's not at blame. They may have gotten the bad end of the stick. They may have really been born into a bad situation. They may currently have stresses and strains that are undue. They could be physically ill beyond what they should be. But it's not anybody else's fault. And now the way we're going to settle into this is not by blaming the world, but getting you to build your strength by showing you how you can be as stable as you possibly could be. And that's what psychotherapy seems to be. Seems to be. You think so, Stephanie?
I do. I think it's a wonderful place to build up all those skills and a good feeling for yourself and the people out there.
How long have you been in this field?
Almost 15 years.
15 years of doing this? Is this what you thought you would be doing?
Yes, I did from a very early age, I knew.
From two. Imagine seeing a young kid, right, 3, 4 years old, and saying, what are you going to be when you grow up? I'm going to be a psychotherapist. I think there would be something wrong. When did you make a decision, Kent, that you were going to do this?
I remember when I was 14 or 15, the PBS, the Nova shows about the brain would come on, and I was fixated, just absolutely fixated on the brain and the mind at that time, and I said, that's what I want to do when I grow up.
You want to be somebody who can help with the mind, understand the mind?
I didn't know. At that point was the brain and the mind. And then as I got into college and medical school, found that what seemed right was psychiatry.
More than brain science? More than brain surgery?
Yeah, I think similar to what was said before, I found when I was in medical school, I would be interested in how people were reacting to having their seizure disorder and reacting to the fact that their father has a brain cancer. So there I was, all the other doctors looking at, you know, very interested in the pathology of the tumor and the like, and there I was looking at the wife crying in the waiting room, and I thought to myself, that's where I want to be. That's what I'm interested in, trying to relieve that pain over there.
It's hard to believe that there's a way that people could build into a profession a service, a true service. You know, there's a heart dedication. It's really nice to be around you folks. This is Armand DeMille. I am talking with three extraordinary people. Ann C. O'Connell, who is a psychotherapist who has worked with a wide range of people, including schizophrenia, drug addiction, so on and so forth, who is joining our staff. Kent Robert Shaw, a psychiatrist who has his own practice nearby, who does both psychotherapy and medication consultation. And Stephanie Dombro, who does individual, family, and group psychotherapy for 15 some odd years. Kind of amazing people. So we will be back with you. If you want to get in touch with them, you could do it through my website. Go through thepositivemind.com. Just say you'd like to speak to one of them. I'll forward the email to them. Or you could call my office at 212-757-4488. That's 212-757-4488. And just to let you know, last week, Kent Robert Shaw did a fine program on medication, the different medications that are used in psychiatry. If you know anybody who is on medication or taking different medications, you want to understand it a little better, you could go to the website and pull up thepositivemind.com, go to the archives, listen to that program from last week, and it's called Psychiatric Medications is the name of it. You could listen to that, or you could call my office and get a copy of it. I will be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends. I'm sorry we didn't take those calls, but these people opened their heart, and I had no choice but to stay with them. Be back with you next Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends. Bye-bye for now.